Hi, I'm Sam Benrubi from the Grape Nation for Heritage Radio Network on tour. We're broadcasting live from the Le Creuset podcast studio at Charleston Wine and Food. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/Charleston2019 to see our full interview schedule. We want to thank Le Creuset and the Julia Child Foundation for making Heritage Radio Network on tour at Charleston Wine and Food possible. I want to welcome our first guest today. Our guest is Jean Trimbach. Jean is the part of the 12th generation family at legendary Alsatian winery Maison Trimbach. Welcome to the Grape Nation, John.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you for taking time from a busy schedule at the festival to sit down with us. So I want everyone to get an idea of who you are or who the family is, and we'll get into the region and we'll get into the winery. But give us a little background on your journey in life and wine that got you to where you are today at the family winery, because you were not always there, right?
Not always.
Okay.
But
so give us a little background.
This is obviously a long story because it all started in 1626. And my brother Pierre and I represent the 12th generation. And the 13th generation has jumped in already, working hard, I hope. And, well, it has been a long legacy since, always run by the family, operated by the family, owned by the family. But at the end of the day, it's a small winery, producing the five classic grape varieties from Alsace. And
let's tell everybody what they are.
Well, primarily, I would say Riesling, Gewürztraminer, Pinot Gris, Pinot Blanc, and tiny bit of Pinot Noir.
Right.
So, brother Pierre and I, my brother Pierre, like I say, is in the kitchen, so to speak, because the kitchen for us are the vineyards, because quality happens in the vineyards. If you don't have quality grapes, you will never produce in the cellar quality wine. So my brother Pierre is in the vineyards, and at the same time, of course, he is in the cellar,
right,
working with the next generation. So we are just actually in transition. We are just like here for a little bit of time.
What, a generational transition?
Yes, generation. Okay. And the 13th generation will take over and hopefully transmit the Trimbach name to the 14th generation. So we just take it easy. Like every great chef, we try to produce the best possible wines. We try to produce the best Riesling, the best Gewürztraminer, the best Pinot Gris, all reflected by the ripeness, but also by the terroir,
right,
by the soil and the subsoil.
Right. We're going to talk about that. I want to talk to you about wines of Alsace. But back to you a little. I mean, as a young man and up until now, you were not always at the winery. I mean, you were in the U.S., you traveled around.
No.
You did a lot of wine biz stuff, right?
Yeah, but at the end of the day, I was always at the winery because for us there was no other choice to work at the winery because our papa, our dad, would only give us a little bit of pocket money if we would work. So we had to work, and I was in the vineyards, I was in the cellar, I did everything, like did my brother, like did our children. And very naturally, we decided to jump in. My brother Pierre is slightly older, so he took vineyards vinification first, and I took what was left. And in fact, my background is accounting.
You have a business background.
Voila.
Okay.
I took what was left, if I may say.
Right. Right. All right. So let's talk about Alsace. So Trimbach is this multi-generational historic, you know, winery. You're in the Alsace. I think there's a lot of fans of Alsace, but I sadly say there are a lot of people that are not that familiar with Alsatian wines or have tasted them. So let's start with the region. Let's talk geography,
okay,
climate, terroir, you know.
Absolutely.
Let's set it up for, you know, what you're doing.
So the region is located northeast part of France. So actually, straight east from Paris. And we are right there on the natural border, and the natural border with Germany is the Rhine River. So that's very clear, straight east from Paris. But what makes Alsace so great, so unique, so interesting, but at the same time so complex, is the multifaceted terroir that we have. Because, you know, we have been, the Black Forest and the Vosges Mountains have been one mountain 50 million years ago. It all collapsed, and because of that collapse, we have so many different soil, and that makes Alsace so interesting. The grape variety, and each of the grape variety, Riesling, Pinot Gris, Pinot Noir, Gewürztraminer, linked with all those different terroirs. We have slate, we have limestone, we have sandstone, we have granite. You name one terroir in Alsace, we have it. So that's the complexity of the soil. And then, of course, not to forget, the microclimate. We have one
because
of the
both, mountains
because
and
of
the river.
Vosges Mountain Range. We have one of the driest climate in France, if not in the world. Because actually, we could compare our rainfall amount, if I may say, to what's happening in Stellenbosch, South Africa. We exactly have the same rainfall amount per year. Roughly 500 to 600 millimeters of rain only.
That's it.
Yeah. So we have everything over there to produce great wines. But I have to confess that the sommelier love it, the chef love these wines because they pair extremely well with food, because they are based on minerality, based on fruitiness, and based on natural ripe acidity. But sometimes people are a little bit put off because, let's face it, the shape of the bottle. The shape of the bottle remind people German wines. And here in the US in particular, sometimes people think that German wines are automatically sweet.
Well,
which is not the case
anymore.
They
go back to what was imported 30, 40 years ago, which were not good wines.
Exactly.
In the long bottles. So that's why I wanted you to sit here, and I wanted people to be more aware of, you know, what Alsace.
So we are suffering a little bit from that history, and voilà, the shape of the bottle. But little by little, I think people realize that Alsace, and our family in particular, if I may say, we produce dry wine, and this is definitely our family style.
Well, that was my next question. There is a specific family style. I mean, there's been a phrase tossed around, the Trimbach style. So let's talk about, get into as much depth of what that style is and how you get there. You know, whether it's from hand harvest, you know, what are all the aspects that make the Trimbach style?
Well, the Trimbach style is like a great chef, or like 10 great chefs. You give them a piece of salmon, and you come out with 10 different preparations.
Right.
It's exactly the same at Trimbach. But the Trimbach style has been inherited from generation to generation. Say, my brother Pierre now has 40 harvests behind him, and each of these harvests have been transferred into a wonderful style, the Trimbach style, which he inherited from our father, Bernard Trimbach.
Right. There's a history of the
there
style.
There is a history.
But I'm also trying to get what that style is. You
and
know,
Bernard Trimbach is 86 years old, and he's still in good shape. And Julien, the 13th generation, will get that style too.
How
which
old is he?
Which is 27 years old.
Okay.
27 years old. Which is, it's all about finesse, elegance, balance. And if you ask my brother Pierre, which are the three conditions to make a great wine, Pierre would say, number one, balance. Number two, balance. Three, balance.
Really?
Absolutely.
That's his priority.
Oui, oui. Balance, balance, balance. Numbers, say residual sugar, like, or alcohol content, or that doesn't matter. It's all about the balance in his palate, in his view. And this is the Trimbach style. But again, the Trimbach style is all about purity, intensity, energy, energy / natural ripe acidity, and overall balance.
Okay, so to get there, there's obviously two important things. That's the farming and agriculture, and then the winemaking. And so how do you farm? Sustainably, organic, you know?
All our vineyards are organically farmed.
Okay.
Absolutely. And I suspect that the new generation, little by little, will go into...
Take it further?
Well, maybe
biodynamic.
Biodynamic, absolutely.
Okay.
But for me, I'm already very happy to say that it's all organic. And then what counts is to be a minimalist in the cellar. In other words, do nothing in the cellar.
No intervention.
No intervention. Let it happen.
So do you gravity press?
Oh, gravity press. So of course, all 100% hand harvested, gravity pressed.
Explain what hand harvesting is.
Well,
it is what it sounds like.
It's all by
the
hand.
The grapes come out of the picking boxes. They go on a conveyor belt.
Yes.
And then what
happens?
Then
they just get into the press.
But people are picking out.
We are picking them
right,
by hand.
They're cut by hand. Sorted by hand.
Sorted by hand. And then we put the entire cluster into the press.
So it's a whole cluster press.
Absolutely.
Which is stems.
Stem and
everything.
Berries. Yeah.
And what does that add to the wine? I mean, obviously that's part of the Trimbach style, but... Does that give the balance that you're going after?
Yes, and because it's a very gentle pressing, it's a very long pressing, 3 to 4 hours, so we get a little bit of natural tannin from the stem, which is part of the structure of the wine as
right.
well. So it's not just the fruitiness, it's the tannin as well, the natural ripe tannin
right.
and all the phenolic aspects.
This is just a curiosity. Other Alsatian winemakers... And I know you don't think about them all the time, but you're aware. Do most of the Alsatian winemakers do whole cluster, or it really varies?
I think it varies, but most of them, at least 80%, I would say, do whole cluster pressing.
They do.
Yes,
so
yes.
So it's an important element of what the region is doing, per se.
It's the tradition.
Right.
The only exception, of course, is the Pinot Noir. Pinot Noir is completely destemmed. Because of it's a long maceration. It's a 10,
right.
12, 15 days maceration. So that would be the only exception.
But, John, there's a movement in Burgundy where they're doing, you know, a whole cluster and all that. You know,
Monsieur
Jair said, you know, de-stem everything, but now you have all these new winemakers.
Yeah.
They want that complexity.
We learn every day, and that's the beauty of our business. The climate change and everything, we always have to adapt. But more important, I think that vineyards really adapt extremely well. I'm very surprised to see, because we had some hot vintages lately. 2018 was one of them, and it was super interesting to see how the vineyards adapted to those conditions.
And they did well?
They did very well. We thought that the quantity, that the volume would be small, short, but at the end of the day, when we started pressing, when we saw the free running juice out of the press, we were like, holy cow, more juice than expected.
Really?
So we were really,
so even
really
the
surprised.
Yields were low,
we were expecting
were
much lower
grapes.
Yields, absolutely.
One last thing about the Trimbach style. We talked about farming, hand harvesting, low intervention winemaking. The finished product... Stainless steel, casks, both. You know, what's your approach on that?
Stainless steel and cask, old cask. So, as you know, in Alsace, we are not talking new oak, barriques, new barriques. But all of us, all the sellers, we have old, traditional, big cask. It's oak, but in many, many occasions, we are talking 40, 50, 60, 70 years old cask, old oak.
Does that
so it's good. It's good for the breathing. It's good for the wine to start a kind of little maturation process before bottling. And this is what we do at Trimbach. We try to capture the fruit, to capture the freshness, to capture all what Trimbach is about into the bottle. In other words, we always bottle our wines the spring following the crop.
Why?
To capture everything in the bottle.
It's a very important timing.
And then, in some cases, we mature those bottles 10 years prior to release. 10 years prior
That's
to release. This is our quality commitment. And one of the Riesling, well-famous Riesling, called Riesling Cuvée Frédéric Émile, or Riesling Clos Saint-Une, which you had in the past, we don't release these wines before 5-7 years because we believe that they are not ready.
Bottle-aged. They're bottled and then the bottles are kept.
Exactly.
So they have some bottle age.
Yeah.
We'll talk about those in a minute. But there's no doubt Riesling is the most emblematic of Alsace grapes, right?
Yes.
Now, all the growers, the majority of vines in the region are planted to Riesling?
Riesling is about 22% of Alsace total plantation.
That's it?
22%.
Okay.
For Trimbach, Riesling, all Rieslings we produce are up to 50% of what we produce.
So you produce, you're a higher production than the region. Is there a larger, Is there a higher percentage of another grape?
No,
Riesling. Everything spreads out.
Riesling is our passion. Riesling is our identity. Riesling is our soul. This is definitely Trimbach. And
okay.
All over the world, because we export 90% of the production, all over the world, the family, the Trimbach family, is known for its Rieslings.
All right, so I'm gonna put you in the hot seat for a second. And as an Alsatian winemaker, I'm going to ask you, how do Alsatian Rieslings differ from German Rieslings? Because the German Rieslings certainly, you know, are out there and have a great reputation. But tell me why.
Well, Sam, to start with, I love them both. I drink them both.
Okay.
I love them
That's
both.
That's the right answer of a true wine guy.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, the difference lies on the terroir, soil and subsoil. The great variety of terroir we have. In Germany, it's mostly slate. In Alsace, we have 5, 6, 7 other different terroirs. So terroir and, as I said before, not to forget the microclimate.
Right.
The microclimate, which pushes the acidity down into the grapes. And therefore, when it comes to the juice and the wine, the acidity and the overall balance is always different from Germany.
So the luxury of the variety of terroir, not terroir, but the soils and the sands, gives Alsace, you know, that edge over Germany, which is, like you said, mostly slate. So right there.
Absolutely.
Because each different, whether it's limestone or sand or whatever, imparts a different, flavor to the wine. Let's talk about other great Alsatian grape varietals. I mean, obviously, mentioned all of them before, but let's enlighten people about,
Riesling, of course, and again, dry Riesling in Alsace. I think that's important to be underlined again. After that, I would say Gewürztraminer, spicier. Gewürz means spicy, spicier Traminer. And the origin of this grape was Trentino Alto Adige. And we inherited Traminer, which became Gewürztraminer in the 1800. And I think that this grape is very interesting as well because of its fruitiness, because of its aromatics, because of its spiciness. And again, Trimbach style Gewürztraminer is dry. Most of the people out there believe Gewürztraminer is sweet, not Trimbach.
So the descriptions of Gewürztraminer are so good. What are the perfect food pairings? It has such a distinct style. There are certain foods that it goes so well with.
Smoked food, smoked fish, smoked pork, smoked barbecue pork, and of course, all what we could eventually find in Asia. Asian food, Thai food, Chinese food, Peking duck, you name it. All Asian food and Gewürztraminer.
That's what I was waiting for you to get to.
But again, dry style Gewürztraminer pair extremely well with these foods.
All right, so we've covered Riesling, Gewürztraminer.
And then
tell me the other great indigenous
let's
grapes.
Let's go for Pinot Gris. let's go for Pinot Gris, which is not Pinot Grigio. Pinot Gris from Alsace is a different grape variety.
So stop and right there. Pinot Gris is not Pinot Grigio.
No.
A lot of people in the United States drink crappy Pinot Grigio. I said it, not you. That's right. Is Pinot Gris a good profile replacement?
Oui.
You know, all the flavor profiles.
Pinot Gris to me, Pinot Gris from Alsace is a great alternative to many, many, many Chardonnay, because Pinot Gris is creamy, Pinot Gris is velvety, Pinot Gris is all about yellow peach fruit, mango fruit, tropical fruit, and so on. I think Pinot Gris is definitely the Alsace alternative to Chardonnay.
Okay. Let's stay in the theme. Great pairings for a Pinot Gris.
Pinot Gris loves the sweetness of the scallops. Pinot Gris loves the sweetness of the lobster. Hey, and because we are in Charleston, soft shell crab.
There
Pinot Gris loves the sweetness of the soft shell crab.
All right, now Pinot Blanc.
Pinot Blanc. You know what? Pinot Blanc is what I call my glue, glue, glue wine.
Okay.
It's the wine I'm drinking from 9 a.m. until 9 p.m. It's very friendly.
Easy
very
drinking.
Easy to drink.
Good food wine?
Good food wine as well. Perfect with oysters, perfect with seafood, perfect with salads, perfect with everything. That's the beauty of Alsace. Alsace wines are extremely versatile. They go with all kind of food, including steak. Including steak. I had some sommelier.
What's the best Alsatian steak wine?
Riesling. Matured Riesling.
Matured Riesling. Matured can hold Riesling. Up to a nice bloody
because of
red
the
steak.
Minerality, because of the structure, because of the acidity, which is a little bit more polished. I had some master sommelier here in the U.S. pouring Riesling with my steak. It was fantastic.
I love hearing that. You should drink what goes well and what you like. Don't let anybody tell you anything else. Now, there's a great grape I want you to talk about, which I know you vinify, and it's delicious, and it's starting to get some more recognition. And that's Sylvaner.
Sylvaner, oui, it's called the sort of forgotten grape, but more and more people pay attention to it again. But I think if there was one grape that I would like to push, is the Pinot Noir. Pinot Noir.
Well, we'll get to that.
Oh, okay, we'll get to that.
But Sylvaner is, tell me a little about the characteristics and quality.
It's again, it's similar to Pinot Blanc. It's not super complex. It has a little higher acidity than Pinot Blanc. I like them both, but again, here in the U.S., I would favor Pinot Blanc.
Okay, and then let's talk about Pinot Noir, because there's great Pinot Noirs from the region. You're not making, of all the wines you make, I would say Pinot Noir is the smallest output. Is that changing?
Yes, you're right. Pinot Noir for us is 10 to 15% of what we produce. I suspect it to be the same for the Alsace region.
Right.
But it's growing because, global warming helping. But at the same time, we have more vineyards of Pinot Noir, and our vineyards are getting older.
So you're committed.
Oui.
The older vineyards, better grapes, better tasting wine.
Absolutely. And Pinot Noir from Alsace is getting better and better. I would really encourage your listeners to really try to try a bottle of Alsace Pinot Noir. And, I think they represent very good value as
yes.
well.
Yes, I think the Alsatian Pinots are great. And certainly you should look for the trim back. We're going to wrap up the show pretty soon, but I can't let you leave without talking about one of the great legendary wines, not from your vineyard, but of the world, and that is the Clos Saint-Hune.
Ah, Clos Saint-Hune.
Thank you.
I didn't want to talk about it because it's such a small production.
I didn't want to spend too much time on it.
Because we never have enough, but Clos Saint-Hune is the iconic dry Riesling in the world. And, people talk about Clos Saint-Hune. They don't even talk about Riesling anymore. They just say Clos Saint-Hune.
Right.
Give me a bottle of Clos Saint-Hune because it's really iconic.
It's its own entity.
It is. It has its little box there, very separate from anything else. And some top sommelier in Alsace call it the Romane County of Alsace. Small vineyard, 1.7 hectare only, so very small production.
What makes the wine
is the high proportion of calcareous and very old vines. Yes.
calcareous is something in the soil, right?
Exactly. Calcareous, so limestone combined with degraded seashell, which we call mussel calc. Mussel calcareous from the mussel, when Alsace, in the old days, 247 million years ago, was recovered with sea.
Great. So that's the Clos Saint-Hugues. That is, if you really want to try one of the great wines of the world, look out for the Clos Saint-Hugues. Jean, we got to wrap up. We could sit here and talk for a long time. There's a lot to talk about. But I appreciate you taking time
Thank you.
Out of the festival to sit with us and enlighten us about the wines of Alsace and certainly about what your family is doing. Thank you to Jean Trimbach from Maison Trimbach. We hope to see you soon.
Thank you so much. And always a pleasure, and always a pleasure to be at the Charleston Wine Festival. Merci.
We hope to see you again. Thank you. We're going to continue on. We're going to sit down with Paul Chevalier. Hi, Paul. Thank you for joining us.
Yes, well, happy to be here.
I'm talking to Paul Chevalier. Paul, is it true you were Massachusetts born?
Yes, actually was my mother's American, born just outside of Boston. My father was French, actually met during the war. So
the Chevalier name.
Yes.
And give me a little background in your journey in life and wine, because you've had a colorful background.
Oh, for sure, yeah. So it's a sort of a long story. It says, you know, in America, most winemakers would go to UC Davis or Fresno State in California
to get
your degree in viticulture. So I went to, in France, we have several schools. I went to the University of Champagne in Reims, where I have my degree in enology. And when I graduated from school many years ago, my first position as a winemaker was with Veuve Clicquot, which was a
legendary champagne house.
Yes, and it was a great experience working with a winemaking team. And I'll be very honest, I wasn't really any smarter than anybody else, but primarily because I spoke English, they said, "Oh, well, we're going to send you, young man, to New Zealand," because in 1989 we purchased a property in New Zealand called Cloudy Bay. So I was able to go to New Zealand and introduce Cloudy Bay in 1991 in New York to America.
Wouldn't you say Cloudy Bay was responsible for that Sauvignon Blanc?
Oh, for sure.
Just the way Santa Margherita, Pinot Grigio.
Establishing the category,
Cloudy Bay really, and it was a terrific product too.
Yeah, and I often say, you know, when you're working today, of course, with Chateau d'Escaut and Whispering Angel, Whispering Angel is perhaps a combination of the Veuve Clicquot marketing, that beautiful, what we call the yellow label, and the innovation of Cloudy Bay, because, again, to make Sauvignon Blanc in New Zealand was very innovative. And I think, you know, what we're doing at Chateau d'Escaut with Whispering Angel is very innovative rosé winemaking.
Right. So we'll get into Declan specifically and the products and all that, but I wanted to ask you about a few things. Why is rosé hotter now than ever? There's always been good makers. You know, it's always been a delicious wine. Some people see it as seasonal, the way they see champagne as celebratory. But it just seems so hot right now. I mean, what's your take on that?
I think, you know, I'll be honest. So you know, with the story with Chateau d'Escaut and, you know, Sacha Lachine and unfortunately, the late Patrick Leon, 2006 was our first vintage. And I remember coming to the United States. It was specifically New York, the Hamptons, a little bit in Nantucket in the summer of 2000.
Rosé market.
Yes, in summer of 2007. Rosé was not trendy at all in the summer of 2007. So this is very, very recent. So it took a lot of time and effort. I think one of the things we do at Chateau d'Escaut Whispering Angel, we do a lot of education. We host, this is why we're here at the Charleston Wine and Food Festival, is over 450 rosé events every year just in the United States alone, teaching and educating about what we consider to be true rosé from Provence, being light and pale, but specifically not sweet. And the biggest challenge we had, again, back in the early days of 2006, 2007, is rosé, as you know, had a very bad reputation in America because of the days of, it went from essentially Matus and Lancers, perhaps in the 70s, then to sort of White Zinfandel in the 80s. And those were all
Sutterholm, White
Sutterholm,
Zinfandel.
For sure. And those were all primarily sweet.
It kind of tainted the image and reputation.
It did. And very few people really, in the United States anyway, really knew and appreciated rosé because they had this misconception that it was a sort of inferior, which it probably was, inferior quality sort of wine, unless they had visited the Côte d'Azur, if they had visited Provence, they would have experienced what we call true rosé. So we've come a long way. I really think it's through education. And
I think that's important.
Yeah.
And getting the right product in front of people. Yeah. Are you one of those guys that thinks only the good rosés come from Provence?
No. Actually, very, very good question. So the challenge we have is, and we're thinking about this, because we're at the stage now where it's going to be very difficult to continue to grow Whispering Angel as a brand just because we don't have enough vineyards and there's none to be able to source the right grapes. So there are two things which I think are different. Is I think not all red grape varietals are ideal for making rosé. I'm not a big fan of rosé from Cabernet Sauvignon.
It seems like the trend, though.
Yes.
Because you pick up a rosé and, damn it, every grape.
Everybody and their mother is making rosé. Probably
with every grape.
With every grape, probably because of the success of Whispering Angel. But the challenge is this.
Well, you were about to answer my question. Is there too much rosé out there in the market, and is quality being compromised? And I think you're about to approach that.
Yes. For us, no, because we're very adamant about what we do. Whispering Angel is still produced at Chateau d'Esclon, so it's not made in a factory nor a cooperative. It's made on site in the same way we started in 2006. Again, getting back to this whole grape conception is making rosé is not that different to I often illustrate making tea. So you have your tea and you sort of seep it, right? And if you seep it a little bit, it's lighter, and the longer you seep it, the darker the tea becomes. But the challenge is, as your tea becomes darker, it also becomes more bitter and astringent. And there's a very fine line between where does a rosé stop and a red wine begin? Think about lighter styles of reds like Beaujolais and Cabernet Francs.
So does grape play into that immediately? Like certain grapes will make it harder?
Yes. So
or easier to get to a darker?
So if you think about varietals that have are really full-bodied, Cabernet Sauvignons and maybe Sangioveses and those, I really don't believe they're ideal. Grenache is, for sure, for us anyway, Grenache produces that elegant style.
Right.
You cannot do that, or maybe Pinot a little bit, I suppose, but you cannot do that with all grapes. So that's the first issue. The second issue is ripeness. To achieve the style of Whispering Angel, which we produce, you do need a relatively warm climate to get these grapes ripe. If you don't, you will always have this issue. Sort of like what happens in New Zealand is cool climate is difficult because you'll have higher levels of acidity, and then you get these styles of rosé that have a little bit of a bite to them.
Yes.
And
bitter bite.
Yes. And the clientele today, maybe they've been spoiled with Whispering Angels, they don't want that. They the first thing they look at is color. They want it light. The second thing is mouthfeel, which is most people taste with their mouth. If it's not smooth and easy drinking.
So what's a good mouthfeel for a good rosé? It's not going to be unctuous or full. It's going to be smooth. I mean, describe to me.
So, again, in Provence, the challenge is we're not allowed, it's against the law of the appellation, to make sweet rosé. So all Provence has to be less than, I think it's either 2 or 3 grams of residual sugar. Whispering Angel is almost zero. It's like 0.02 or something. Wow. And since you don't have any sugar, remember, sugar is kind of what masks a lot of the sort of herbaceousness and flavors, is you have to be very careful that your wine is pure with fruit. So to answer your question is, rosé in your mouth should be smooth, and as it goes down, almost a sort of a viscosity, a certain thickness, which is not because of the sugar. It's probably more like glycerin and other things.
Right.
But it just goes down, and there's no bite. And this whole expression of rosé all day is really about you can drink it.
If you're feeling that, you'll drink it all day.
You drink it like water. And it's funny. I often joke about this. You don't just drink a glass of rosé. Before you know it, you drank the whole bottle.
Yeah, that's for sure. Just like champagne, which I think it was perceived as a celebratory drink.
For sure.
Less and less now. It's a great food pairing wine. It's not a lot of wine lists and all that. Rosé has been perceived as a summer drink.
Oh,
And I think you answered part of it. By educating people, you make them aware. But how do you dispel that?
Well, again, we remember, and I would say technology as well. We've come a long way because I remember, I'll be honest, when I was a young man, I really didn't like Rosé. There were very few that I think were you know, top quality. Of course, you had Domaine Ud and Tampier, you know, some of these domains in France, but a lot of them. And my father drank Tavel, which was this, and I didn't really like Tavel because it was kind of rough and tough, and you drank it 3 or 4 years after it was released, and it started to turn brown. But I think with, you know, properties like Chateau d'Esclon, the investment in technology, winemaking material, never happened in the south of France. Everybody in Bordeaux invested because they had more money. Everybody in Champagne invested. In the south of France, they were rather poor. So what we used to call the QB, which is like a jug, we would go to the cooperative and get a QB of rosé for 6-7 francs, drink it with some ice cubes in the summertime, and then by the time summer was over, that was the end of it. That's really rich. So there's the rosé winemaking has become much more serious, technologically sound, and the rosés that are being produced today were not produced even 10 years ago. So it's almost a rosé revolution is going on.
Past decade.
Yeah, and because of investment. So one of the challenges we had, I remember, with Whispering Angel is we're a little bit more expensive than other rosés, and when we first released it, there was resistance from the buyers and the restaurants, and they said, oh, it's too expensive, it's never going to sell. And I said, well, why does rosé have to be the $9.99 special? What if we made a better rosé, people will pay more money for it? And we've proven with Whispering Angel that can be done.
Yeah, so. I mean, that's an important aspect. Let's talk about Chateau d'Esclon. No doubt you make some of the buzziest, which is a cool thing, some of the most sought-after rosés. Sasha took over the winery, like you said, in 2006. How did all that happen? I think the answer, it starts with product, but...
It does, and in a vision, Sasha is certainly a visionary. And actually, to be honest, a lot of people thought he was a little crazy because he sold, you know, his father had this property in Margaux, Prairie de Chien. He sold that, and everybody said, how can you sell your father's property? And invested, of course, in Provence to make the best rosé in the world. And everybody said, you're crazy. But, you know, he proved them wrong with this investment, with this technology, that rosé doesn't have to be cheap and cheerful swimming pool wine. It can be a really serious wine. And as we get to, you know, some of the other expressions we make, like the L'Eclan or the Garousse, many people confuse them, and that reminds us a little bit of a white Burgundy, like a Chassin Montrachet or a Meursault. And that really did not exist before Sasha in 2006.
So let's talk about that. Those are two bottlings, the L'Eclan and the Garousse.
Yes.
So those are the two premium luxury.
Yes,
bottlings. I don't know how you describe them.
Well, the concept was because we had these vineyards of old vine to make small batches, sort of like in Burgundy. So the L'Eclan Garousse is very similar in production. So old vines, L'Eclan is 56-year-old vines, and the Garousse is almost 100-year-old vines. Take the juice. The same process as making Whispering Angels. So we let the skin Grenache, let the skin soak 3 hours, 3.5 hours. But instead of putting the juice pink into a stainless steel tank, which is the standard practice, we said, why don't we barrel ferment? And that had never been done before. And it said, so it created a style which is, and I've had actually, and Sasha was there, is we did these sommelier tastings in the United States, in New York and Las Vegas. And one of the sommeliers said, well, that doesn't taste like rosé. And Sasha says, well, who are you to tell me what rosé should taste like? So, I mean.
And nobody was barrel fermenting?
No, that didn't exist.
So you innovated.
Burgundy winemaking techniques. And we couldn't use a normal size barrel, which is 220, because otherwise it would be too oaky.
Right.
So we went to a large, what we call a demi-muit. First vintage was 2006, was a 500-liter demi-muit. It came out a little too oaky. So very quickly we went to a 600-liter demi-muit, French oak.
You kept tweaking it.
And then it kept... And it's true, the first year we only made 3 barrels. And we didn't even know if we could sell it. And we said, well, Sasha said, if we can't sell it, at least we can drink it.
Well, that worked out well. So there's Whispering Angel, Garris. Let's talk about some of the other rosés.
Okay.
That are there, that are, you know, even more accessible, price points a little less.
Yes.
Tell me about your other SKUs.
So we just released this year. This is one of the
reasons. Did you bring something in for us to drink?
I brought us, yes.
Bring me a glass over so I can glug this with Paul?
Yeah, it's this. Well, it's that time of day, right? Rosé time of day. I mean,
that's right.
In France, it's probably aperitif time. So
that's okay. Thank you. So we're drinking
the new vintage.
New vintage of Whispering Angel.
2018.
Tell us quickly about it.
So this is we picked in September of 2018. We bottled just before Christmas, in late December. And this is now in America, and we're in early March, and we're drinking the new rosé from Provence of Whispering Angel, Grenache based. Although we do use another grape, which we call Roll, which is R O L L E. Roll is the French word for vermentino.
So it's a white
grape. And Provence, it's planted. Very few places in France actually make Roll as a white, maybe in Corsica. But it's a very good blender. It adds in sort of aromatics. If you think about, you know, vermentino, it kind of pops, very floral.
Yes.
And that kind of mouthfeel. So one of the secrets of Whispering Angel is a little bit of Roll in the blend. Mm. And just that sort of rich sort of smoothness and just very accessible, very drinkable.
It's delicious. And then there's a couple other, Rock Angel, Leclan, right?
Yes. So
let's talk about those quickly. So, and Palm.
So there are two separate things. We have Chateau d'Escalon, which is Whispering Angel, and then from the vineyards behind the property, that's where the Rock Angel comes from. And the Rock Angel is called Rock Angel because it comes from a very rocky soil. So rocky soil produces these characteristics of minerality. You're just with Jean Trimbach, so we understand minerality from Alsace. Okay. And then Lake Longarousse being the more barrel-fermented, oak-aged, single vineyards. The Palm, which is one of the reasons why we have this Rosé Oasis at the Charleston Wine and Food Festival, is we released the Palm a little bit last year as a test, but this is the official kickoff is this year, and the Palm will be, as we speak, rolling out in supermarkets like Target and places. And we did it for one specific reason. As you mentioned, the rosé category has exploded. A dozen rosés in 2006. Today, in the last 3 to 4 years, there must be 400 new rosés that have hit the market from all around the world, California and Argentina and Chile and Italy and Spain. The challenge is, I think the consumer, you have to be very careful, can get a little confused. Some of these rosés, remember this idea of rosés being from Provence being dry. So a lot of these especially more of the commodity brands, are sweet. And so it would really upset me if we go back 30 years and start reintroducing sweet rosés in America when Whispering Angel has been spending so much time and energy to teach what real rosé is, dry rosé. So the Palm, it's actually the Palm by Whispering Angel is the name. And it's almost like, you know, you have Duckhorn and Duckhorn has Decoy.
Right.
So it's our second label.
Great hybrid, great maker.
When we designed it to make it more approachable, not for the Whispering Angel consumer. The Whispering Angel consumer is already... they're locked in for life. I'm focusing on the Generation Z. So they're just coming 2021. They don't necessarily know very much about wine. They probably heard rosé is trendy. They probably go to the Rosé Mansion in New York City and take pictures and Instagram. But they don't really know so much about wine. So the Palm is to educate these young ones and set them on the right path of rosé. And someday they'll graduate to Whispering Angel, to Rock Angel, and maybe even Garousse. So it's a whole evolution of your palate. And the Palm is meant to design that.
All under one roof.
All under one roof.
We have to wrap up in a couple of minutes, but I need you to tell me a couple of things. Best food pairings for rosé. I know it's a general question, and each, you know, bottling differs a little. But
for sure.
Rosé,
well,
if you're eating it with food, drinking it with food.
I think it's interesting. So, and Sasha will say this, is you know, specifically Whispering Angel. If you think conceptually, rosé in your mouth... it starts like a white, but it kind of finishes a little bit like a red because you have a little bit more body. Therefore, you can get away with a lot more pairings. So traditional south of France Mediterranean cuisine, yes. So salad niçoise and bouillabaisse and those sort of things. If you extend throughout the Mediterranean coast, Spain and Italy, now you're onto hams and charcuterie and cheeses and things. Okay, salads. But why not Asian fusion, you know, that sort of spice that you get in sort of, you know, Thai.
Sean was talking about Gewürztraminer.
Yes.
Tremonier.
Yes.
This would be another good match
idea.
For Asian.
Yeah, and sushi, why not? And then I'll flip the other side in, you know, sort of American, like Bobby Flay, you know, spicy barbecue. Why not? It holds up quite well to those types of flavors as well. So really, I think...
pretty versatile.
Across the board. Yeah.
Pretty versatile. Last question. Best temperature to serve rosé.
So,
I think people may throw it in the refrigerator. Yes. They may put it in an ice bucket. Yes. That may be too cold. Yes. I don't think it should be served without temperature. So tell people to enjoy rosé. Temperature-wise.
Yes. So, again, it's depending. Now, if you're in an outdoor situation, it's difficult because your wine warms up. But the golden rule
When you start.
For me, the golden rule is, if I keep it in, which most people do in the refrigerator, is you take the bottle out, you pour it. If your glass steams up, it's too cold.
Okay. I've never heard that before.
And then once you spin, the glass doesn't steam up, then it's at the right temperature.
Great. Paul, I want to thank you for coming in.
No, of course.
We're going to wrap up. Thank you for talking about rosé. Thank you for talking about Chateau d'Erclin. We got a chance to talk about, some of the wines and the grapes and all of that. If people want to find out more about the wines, what's the best place for them to go?
So we have our website is esclans.com. Or if you happen to be traveling in the south of France, if you're in Nice or Cannes or Saint-Tropez or Monaco, every day we have private tours and tastings. We'd love to have you come and visit Chateau d'Esclans, where we produce all these rosés. We'll teach you in person, and we'll show you the secret chapel where the name of Whispering Angel was invented.
Very cool. Nice history. All right, so that's where you should go. Paul, thank you for taking time out of a busy festival. We've been talking to Paul Chevalier. We're going to bring in Eric Asimov from the New York Times to come in. Thank you, Paul. My guest today, or my next guest, is Eric Asimov. Eric is the chief wine critic for the New York Times. Eric, this is your second or third Charleston? You've been here a few times.
Either fourth or fifth.
Fourth or fifth.
I've lost count.
You're like a master guy here. I want to welcome Eric back to the Grape Nation because Eric has graced our hot seat here. And thank you for taking some time to sit with us.
It's my pleasure.
I want to tap into you and sort of get a bunch of information out of you while I have you here. The year is not that old. I want to look back at 2018.
Okay.
And I want you to talk to me about some wine stories, trends, happenings that were significant in your mind, what you wrote about, what you thought personally, that interested you and caught your attention.
Well, it's always funny to talk about wine trends, especially if you're linking them to a year, because it's as if for human benefit, things happened in 12-month calendar increments.
And I really knew there wasn't an easy answer.
No, I
dumb
went for
question,
the New York
smart
Times.
Answer.
We can't operate in four-word sentences. But really, most trends in wines are they're like plants.
Or stories.
They keep growing. Yeah, stories. You don't know exactly which direction they're going to go in, but they keep going, or they turn back. So something like rosé, for example, which your previous guest was talking about, that's been like a monster for 10 years now. And I was just talking to somebody last night here in Charleston who actually makes a rosé and sells it around the U.S. And he said he had a lot of his 2017 left over. And another guy chimed in, aha, the correction is beginning. And I don't think so.
I don't either.
I don't think
but
so at
you
all.
You said it's been hot 10 years. You got to admit, the last 3, 4, 5 have even been hotter.
Yes, because you move from something that is has always been there and has been rediscovered, and maybe it's sommeliers, maybe it's wine writers asking people to take another look at this rosé, and then it moves into the realm of marketers and products and commerciality, and that can have an effect, especially with social media and somebody like
totally
Kim Kardashian showing a photo of her
favorite
bottle.
Marketing. But one of the people you spoke to alluded to the fact that he had some wine left over. Is there any credence to maybe there is some fatigue towards interest in rosé or drinking? Or are you feeling that?
I'm sure there is inevitably a backlash because once you get, you know, people like Kim Kardashian and of course, Jolie and Pitt
right.
involved, then, you know, there's always...
Jon Bon Jovi.
Yeah. I mean, inevitably, people are going to turn their back on it because it's no longer just a wine. Now it's a measure of your hipness or lack thereof, of your character. It becomes a connotation and a badge. So, you know, that's the weird thing about wine. You know, it's very much its own beverage, and we can assess it on whether we like it or not. But it also becomes a status symbol, even for the people who are most against status symbols.
Right.
So, the anti-status symbol people have their own wines.
Right. The natural wine.
Right.
Winner.
Right.
But that's what you said before. It sort of begs the question. I mean, what effect is social media having on wine? How we perceive wine, you as a journalist, how it's affecting wine journalism. I mean, those are all in different places, but...
It has a huge effect because it's now, you know, among the most potent methods of marketing wine. And so when somebody like LeBron James, for example...
Very
LeBron
hot in the
James
market now on that.
Has really gotten into wine, and maybe counterintuitively, he actually has great taste in wine. And when he posts a bottle on Instagram, people freak out. Same with, I mentioned Kim Kardashian and any other celebrities. And I know I have two children in their 20s. And they're, you know, they don't
stare at their phone, right?
Oh no! Of course they do.
Yeah, that's right.
And you know, they're very attuned to social media, and in probably, you know, beyond Twitter and Instagram, which are my realms, they've got their own areas. And when their friends talk about wine, you know, they're very much into that.
The LeBron, the Kardashian thing is influencer marketing, you know, which could go across any product. I don't know if this is the right question, but is that a good thing, a bad thing for wine? You know, if LeBron jumps into wine, is that good for wine? Is it bad for wine? I mean, does it matter what the wine is?
Well, you know what? It depends on where you're standing. Obviously, if you're in the wine business and you depend on selling more bottles, it's a great
thing.
Damn thing.
But
the more people who have any level of hipness or any sort of following who are shown to be wine drinkers, that's a great thing for selling wine.
Put your journalist hat on and your critic hat on. Answer the question that way, where a LeBron is, you know, pushing wine or Brad Pitt and Angela. I mean,
well, it's irrelevant to me. I mean, I love wine, and part of my job is to kind of inspire people to want to be curious about it and explore for themselves. But I'm most definitely not a member of the wine trade, and whether people sell more bottles or don't sell more bottles, it's not something I have a stake in. I have a stake in
right.
in covering.
And I think the answer, it's irrelevant to me, is it's really the straight out, you know, right answer. That's just a whole different segment in all of that.
It's about
the wine.
What is good, what is helpful is for somebody like LeBron, who is interested in good wines and not merely commercial wines or self-aggrandizement. Kim Kardashian, you know, eventually, whatever she's putting on Instagram, she has her own commercial stake in.
Different approaches, LeBron and Kim. Yeah.
And, you know, LeBron has the virtue of being genuinely curious about wine and really kind of a dedicated explorer. And there's no better wine consumer than somebody who explores.
And he's going to touch a lot of new wine people, you know, his followers, that demographic, in all aspects.
You can actually see it in the NBA itself already, because wine has become this hot thing. And you know, it's not just LeBron. Greg Popovich, of the coach of the Spurs, is a great wine drinker. Kevin Love, because of LeBron, has become big into wine. So it's both a team building thing. Dwayne Wade has his own winery.
I like that. I like the fact that they can introduce wine.
It adds to the more conventional demographic for wine.
Yeah. I know I asked you about 2018, and you eloquently
waffled?
Answered. No, opposite. it's hard to put it in a 12-month window.
There's a lot more to say about it.
No, well, then let's look forward a little. I mean, as we look forward into 19 or the future of wine, I mean, what are the things that are interesting you or you're covering or, changes?
Well, you can divide this into kind of stylistic issues and structural issues. And one of the big focuses for me in 2019 is climate change. And, of course, climate change affects everybody's life. And, we're all being told that we're sort of at this make or break period. But because wine is so clearly and demonstrably an agricultural product,
Connected to climate.
The accelerating pace of climate change is really changing the way wine is made and will do so at a much more accelerated pace in the future.
We had Alan Meadows on in the last week, and he talked about how in 100 years they didn't harvest in August, and in the last 10 they've done it like two times or something. That's not the exact statistics. No. And we've had winemakers on, and the whole schedule and everything has changed.
What he's saying is absolutely correct. Things that used to be a once in a century phenomenon are now a once every 3 year phenomenon. So that doesn't just go for harvest. It goes for catastrophes. It goes for hailstorms, spring frost, wildfires, all of these things are incredibly detrimental to wine. But there are there's another side to it. England wasn't known for wine. I mean, even 25 years ago, there was a sort of nascent sparkling wine production in England. It's accelerated at an incredible rate in the last 7 or 8 years, and they're making fantastic sparkling wines there now.
Yeah, they're getting a lot of notices for that.
Yeah.
So we can't change climate, so that goes back to the winemaker. That means he has to change the way he grows, farms, harvests, right?
Exactly.
I mean, I guess it's earlier, and he's got to worry about ripeness, sweetness, and all that.
Well, a lot of this is going to be dependent on big facilities, big production facilities with a lot of money to do the necessary experimentation and exploration. And that includes going up in elevation, planting vineyards at elevations that, for as long as we've known about wine, weren't really considered places where you could ripen grapes. But now they are.
South America?
Well, South America.
Malbec, high elevations.
There's a lot of experimentation going on in Spain. Looking at new or very old varieties of grapes that were maybe thought to be too acidic. Now you need that acidity to in the heat.
Explain to me, because I don't understand. We talk about climate change. We talk about looking into going into higher elevations. In reference to climate change, why go into higher elevations?
It's cooler, for one thing.
So you're getting away from the heat and all of that. So you're forced up there.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people have made wines in higher elevations. But they literally may have to run for the hills.
Have to run for the hills, and also, going farther north or farther south, as in the southern hemisphere, as you see with England. Apparently, there are vineyards now in Scandinavia.
That type of climate.
Canada is a good example.
They're starting to make more wine
than
ice wine.
Great wines coming out from Niagara they're not ice wines. They're just
I'm
really
saying
good still
regular wines.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
And I guess, can you fit Finger Lakes into that? I mean, generally, it's a shorter...
Yeah, I think so.
But climate change will still affect them.
Climate change just is going to make it easier for them. It you know, you had to plant vineyards really close to the lakes so you could have that so-called lake effect, which kept things warmer in,
right,
in the winter and cooler in the summer.
Right.
You know, now it's... Well, you know, Finger Lakes is a strange area, and I guess now that I think about it, you still can't go that far from the lakes, but you
no.
won't be threatened in the winter with vine-killing freezes.
But they're subject to the claims and changes in climate, too.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah. even though it's a different microclimate and all that, I wanted to tap into you. I mean, Eric is the guy that conceived $25 and under a guide to restaurants. Where you really, in your early days, went
yeah.
out and found the great food and great values. I've been following you for a long time, and you do, is it an annual or more than once a year, 20 wines under $20?
Well, probably like three or four times a year.
It is three or four times.
Yeah.
Okay, because I wasn't sure. And I think your opportunity to cover stories deeply and taste a lot of wines, you really get to taste the world, and your list... 20 wines under $20
yeah.
is very extensive as far as diversity,
yeah.
Which is really nice. So let's talk about some regions and grapes, winemakers in there and moving forward, you know, that are exciting you. I'm not asking you to comment on all 20, but
yeah.
there were some things there that repeated.
Well, the thing about looking for good value in wine is that you have to find a place that doesn't have a... sort of a built-in rise in price because it's already got high status.
Right.
So you're never going to...
What's a good example of that?
Like, you're never going to find Burgundy in,
right.
a, in
Done.
A 20... Forget it.
Napa Cab.
You know? I mean, technically, you could say Beaujolais, but even Beaujolais has gotten way up in price, so that is not always an easy answer for the under $20.
So your challenge is to go under those and find the...
Yeah. And this is, you know, the great thing about today, and it keeps getting greater if you ask me about trends, you know, there are so many places in the world, and I'm not talking about new places, South America or the U.S., I'm talking about ancient winemaking regions that are basically unknown to the outside world because for all of history, these regions were local. They made the wine and they drank the wine there.
Give me an example of that region. Eastern Europe?
Well, no. Let's talk about Portugal. Let's talk about the Baga grape, which it's a fantastic red grape, and it's native to the Barreira area of Portugal, which is a little bit north of Lisbon, and you know nobody really did anything with it. It made in sort of a rustic way, very tannic red wines, but. People who have been approaching it with the idea of making fresh, lighter red wines, and it's just brilliant, spicy, delicious.
So what was the name of the grape again?
The Baga.
Spell?
B-A-G-A.
It spells like it sounds.
Just, yeah. It's like the rare Portuguese grape that an English speaker can pronounce.
Now, we're New Yorkers. We're down right. in Charleston. A lot of our listeners are in big cities. Can you find... wines made from the Baga grape?
Yeah, you can. You know, you generally have to have a really good wine shop.
Right.
You know, that's stocked by somebody who loves wine and is not just, like, getting the commercial verities. I'll give you another example. We know in the Piedmont region of Italy, it's famous for Barbaresco and Barolo.
Nebbiolo.
Nebbiolo grape, to a lesser extent, Barbera and Dolcetto. But there's, at least a half dozen other red grapes that are just wonderful, that are almost like little fragments of Nebbiolo, like Fresa or... I'm not going to...
Fresa's Freisa.
Exactly.
Like a Freisa Lange wine?
Yes.
Okay. That's these a good... Give me one or two more if you can remember.
Yeah, I'm having a little wine vapor lock at the moment, but Ruche is another.
Spell.
R-U-C-H-E.
Ruche. Okay. Yeah. Those are great. If you like that region,
these are wonderful grapes.
We've discussed this before, and you've always said this, because there's been talk about supermarket wines, mass-produced wines. You try to deliver a list to people of wines under $20. You always said that in order to drink good or decent wine, there's a minimum price entry point. Like, you ain't going to get a good wine for $5.
No.
But in order to put your hands on a decent bottle, and we're not going to get specific if it's supermarket.
Yeah.
Where do we have to start on that? Is it $20 or is it
no,
less?
No, I mean, I've made the case that the best values are $15 to $25. And, you know, for convenience sake, I've kept it at $20. But I'm going to test myself this year by trying to do under $12 wines just to see, because some, you know, it's all a question of your priorities in life. For me, if I can find exciting wines for $20 or under, I'm very happy. Some people say, you know, wine's not that important to me. Why can't I find a I'm never going to spend more than $8 or something like that.
Right.
And
The root question was, are you going to get anything decent for $8?
Well, you know, people have different standards for what they're looking for. And, you know, if people just want a well-made, sound wine that they can enjoy with their friends or while, you know, watching television or whatever, and they're happy with that, that's great. But for the most part, because the way to keep the price so low is through means of production, you know, automating, industrializing.
That's manipulating the wine.
And often you end
We're
up manipulating the wine.
We're fans of agricultural wines.
You have to farm, you know, huge swaths of vineyard, and the easiest and most efficient way to do that is with a lot of chemical herbicides and machine harvesting, and any deficiencies in the grapes you can make up for in the winery, and you keep costs down.
That's the majority of wines that are drunk.
But, you know, I like to think of it, I like the analogy of restaurants. I mean, if you look at the restaurants that most people go to, like the majority of restaurants that they go out to dinner at, they are fast food restaurants or chain restaurants. And that's fine. People are happy with that.
That's the majority of their consumption.
Yes, but there's a minority of people who are truly interested in skilled visionary chefs, the corner bistro, exploring esoteric cuisines, going to fancy Italian or French restaurants, and maybe not even fancy, but it's a little bit like that with wine. It's where if you love wine and you want to explore and taste what's great at any price, and great can be $20 or less.
Right. But you mentioned
that's what you look for.
You're going to do some research on wines in the $12 range, right?
Yeah.
So you're going to dig deep into that.
And the reason is because readers, you know, enough readers have said, $20... We're students. We can't afford that.
That's a little too high.
You know, so I'm gonna see what's there. I kind of know what I'm gonna find.
Well, that's what I was gonna ask you. I mean, is the result inevitable? You know, where there may not be a lot, or you'll be surprised.
I think I will find good wines, but they will lack a little of the excitement and maybe complexity of some of the slightly more expensive wines, and they're going to be in really short supply. So
right.
You're going to find, you know, the really worthy wines at that price range are going to be made by small producers in pretty much unknown European regions, because they don't have the same labor or real estate costs that we do in the New World.
Right.
And
so when are
people get mad for another reason then.
When are we going to start hearing about the fruits of your tastings and research on $12.
This will be within the next 6 weeks or so.
All right, so keep an eye out for Eric Asimov of the New York Times in a couple of months. After following his 20 and under, we may have some great recos for some $12 wines. All right, I want to thank Eric Asimov for coming in. Before I let you go, just tell me what you're drinking now.
bottle of water.
And this is not to incriminate you or be inclusive or exclusive or whatever, but does everything relate to a column or research?
Mostly they relate to a column.
Give me one or two bottles on the table.
I've been drinking a lot of bubbles recently.
Not just champagne?
Not just champagne, although I love champagne. I've been drinking a lot of Petion Naturel, or Pet Nats, as people call them.
Natural wines, nice to hear Eric drinking that.
And it's kind of amusing when people say, oh, you know, Pet Nat, it's the new rosé, it's the new sparkling wine. No, the way you make a Petion Naturel is by using the ancestral method.
Right.
The oldest method.
Method ancestral, yeah.
Right.
Well, people should be drinking more Pet Nats. That's a whole nother show, Pet Nats and natural wines and all that.
Also a lot of Greek wines.
Whites and reds?
Whites. I recently did a column on Retsina, which is always been scorned and despised. And you know, one of my beliefs is that when you criticize or scorn a region, a style of wine, there's always a great example of that style at its best that you can fall in love with.
So Retsina is one of them.
Retsina.
Those are all good recos. I post a lot of this info on our sites so that we could go beyond the interview and share everything. I want to thank Eric Asimov. Eric is the wine critic for the New York Times. Thank you for taking time out. Thank you for coming back. Thank you for all the info. And enjoy the rest of the festival.
Thanks for having me,
all
Sam.
All right. Thank you, Eric.
Take care.
We're going to sit down with Andre Mack now. Welcome to the Great Grape Nation, Andre.
Thank you so much.
When I saw you were down here.
Yeah?
And I knew we were doing a bunch of shows, I wanted to track you down and try to get you on.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you so much. I think it's great.
I think you've been out there doing this for a while.
Yeah.
And I think you have a heck of a story to tell.
Yeah, thank you.
So I think one of the things we should kick off with is give people a little background on your journey in life and wine.
Got
you to where you are, which we'll talk about.
No,
you know,
absolutely.
Which is your own wine.
My background is restaurants. I worked in a whole bunch of kind of not so glamorous restaurants, you know. As a kid, you know, I worked at McDonald's, worked at Jack in the Box. I worked at, then I upgraded a little bit. I worked at Red Lobster.
Okay.
None of those places.
All the hits.
That have wine lists. And, you know, it was kind of the thing of going on to bigger and better things as I finished school or were done with school. And I ended up working in finance. And that didn't kind of hit the notes that I really wanted it to hit as far as, you know, what it showed me is I wanted interaction with people. And I didn't get that. And I decided to go back to restaurants. And at that point, I really had caught the wine bug. I had watched old episodes of Frasier. And it was through their love of wine and that their enthusiasm about wine really wanted me
so
to
Frasier
invite
So Frasier was
wine.
An influence.
Oh, a huge
That's
influence.
A first on this show.
No, the huge, the biggest. And, like,
That's
the
funny.
Fact of it is that they... Actually, they were dispersing real wine knowledge on that show. The
right.
reason why I knew 61 Bordeaux was a great vintage was from watching that show before I picked up any book. And so
well, the guys that were writing it,
yeah,
were probably
no, it was amazing. Yeah, absolutely,
they were dropping
yeah,
real stuff.
Totally. You know, and then you have that full circle moment where now I find myself on the floor at the French Laundry as one of the sommeliers, and a guest brings in a bottle
but
of 61.
Quickly, how'd we get to the French Laundry?
You were working
as a sommelier.
I was working
down
as a
south.
Sommelier in Texas. I
did some certification in contesting.
Yeah, you know, I think for me, I wanted to try everything. I wanted to figure out, like, all this knowledge that I had in my head, you know, did I actually know it and those kind of things? And I felt like the only way to do that was through competitions. You know, so I won several competitions, found myself at the French Laundry, and that
but
was
the
kind
competitions
of the really
got people's attention.
Yeah,
Let's
I think
not
so.
Sell
yeah,
that show so
well, yeah,
short.
Well, yeah, no, it did, right? But I think it was the journey along the way that actually landed me the job, right? You know, so meeting someone like Paul Roberts, you know, at Cafe Annie in his heyday on a Thursday, that. Same week, earlier that week on Monday, he accepted the job to be the wine director for all of Thomas's properties. I caught him on a Thursday at the end of that night of working service. He's like, hey, kid, do you want to come to the French Laundry with me? And I'm like, the fuck I do.
Right.
Right? You know what I mean? Like, are you kidding me?
No lapse.
Yeah. No, not even close. And
so you pack up, you go to French Laundry.
I went on the next day. You know, it took a few months, but, like, I eventually made my way to the French Laundry. And the whole idea was that's where I was going to stay. I had no real desire to move to New York.
So whether you revealed it or not, did you feel you were ready? Were you intimidated? Or are you like, I got this? What was your feeling?
I think the interesting thing for me was more like, I wasn't real sure. I had never worked in a fine dining restaurant, so that's why I felt like I was off guard. But the fact of it was is that I knew that there was going to be nobody there that worked harder than me. That was just never going to happen.
Hustle.
You know, I worked 33 days in a row as soon as I landed there, right? It was all about, you know, how can I get two for one? Every day that I spent at the restaurant needed to be the equivalent of two or three or more days. And, you know, for anybody who's ever worked with me, you can vouch for that. They will totally vouch for that. And I just worked my ass off. And eventually, as the hype started to build for New York, I felt like I couldn't sit on the sidelines for the chef's homecoming, and it was something that I wanted to be a part of. And
So what are you alluding to? You do how many years at French Laundry?
Yeah, so like 2 years or something like that, Yeah.
You're talking about moving east to Per Se?
So then I moved to New York and opened up Per Se, and I ran the
beverage
department there for 3 years.
Which was Thomas Keller's first New York.
The sister restaurant.
Very anticipated restaurant.
And I had like this amazing time. It was really wonderful. It was really great. It was kind of like written straight out of a fairy tale book.
So there's a funny side story I want you to tell. I picked up this book about a woman who talked about the behind the scenes thing in the restaurant world.
Yes.
And it did focus specifically on Per Se.
Yes.
And, you know, I loved it because I love that kind of crap.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I think it was a bestseller and all
that. Yeah, yeah.
Tell me who that person is.
That's actually my wife now.
Okay.
I met this woman. Give me the connection and talk about the book quickly.
Yeah,
so she... I met my wife. She was a waiter, a captain, the first female captain on the floor at Per Se. She had waited on Frank Bruni maybe 4 out of the 5 times that he actually came to the restaurant.
She writes about that.
Yeah. So she writes about that in the book. I had met this woman, and she, you know, this is kind of around the craze of Sex in the City. And she's talking to me about, you know, what she wants to do in life. I want to be a writer, and I want to write a column. And so she's going through this whole process of, like, about what's cool about a column. When you write a column, that you can put all of those pieces together, write it forward, and now it's a book. And all throughout when she worked at Per Se, she was going to Sarah Lawrence for her MFA, and she was writing these small stories about what was happening in her life. And one day I just came to her. I said, well, you already have a book. You've been writing a column this whole time about what's going on in your life. Package that together, and that should be a book. And then she went on to write this book, which is more, was less about a tell-all, maybe a tell-some, but was really a love letter to the restaurant industry, and to myself, right? The book is about an Ivy League educated woman who found herself at the most anticipated restaurant opening in New York City in the last 25 years. And so she writes about that. And then she meets a dark and mysterious and handsome sommelier. That's me.
2 out of 3.
And that was kind of it. And I think we have aspirations to do all these different things in life, but sometimes we really need a push and something that actually pushes over the edge. And not actually really physically having to choose between this woman that I loved and the restaurant that I worked at. As you can imagine, it was uncomfortable. She wrote this book that Thomas didn't really approve of, but it gave me the push and the urge to say, you know what? I wanted to continue to learn about wine, and I felt like the only way to do that was to go out and make my own. This was an extraordinary job, once in a lifetime. I think most people who work there will never leave it. And I think some of that is afraid of what's next, or not wanting to confront what's next. And
it's
for
a certain
me,
kind of person, then.
I realized that I needed to go somewhere else.
We'll talk about what you did or doing
now,
but I just want to get your take on a few things.
Yes.
There's definitely a new generation of wine drinkers out there, right?
Absolutely.
I think that you're keying into that in two different ways. First of all, what is that? Who is the new generation of wine drinkers? Is it millennials? Is it a little older? I mean, what is it?
Well, I think it's all of that, right? I think all of the people who felt that they weren't included, that wine wasn't a part of who they were. They didn't look at wine and feel like they could be a part of it. And I think when you have, so that is millennials, and that's also people, I don't even know what the fuck generation I am, or whatever they call that.
People felt left out on the wine thing.
Correct. And I think a lot of times when I say that, a lot of people obviously gravitate to people who look like me, and that is one. But also it's just younger people when they can identify with someone that they realize that, oh, wow, like this is not just for you know, they think about wine. They think about it's a guy in a suit with an ascot on.
Right.
Right? And then they see someone show up that's got, like, fucking wearing Vans or, like, listen to a certain type of music. Like, they didn't realize that that included them. And that, you know, I feel like just me being visible and being out there, you know, that helped people say, oh, wow, you know, I show up to places. People are like, well, you don't look like any winemaker I've ever seen before. And then I start laughing. They're like, no, I'm just talking about the glasses, the earrings, right, and the hats. And I was like, I know exactly what you're talking about.
It's like
and
when a female sommelier comes in here. Hey, where's the sommelier?
Yeah, yeah, like, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So that's a good segue into my next question, because I think you're very skillful at this. And it'll lead into talking about Maison Noir wines. How instrumental has social media been for you, your mission, your brand, and all that? And think about doing this, you know, without it.
Well, I mean, this is the interesting thing. I discount a lot of that in a lot of ways, in a weird way. I've only embraced social media, or only been an early adapter of it because of my friend Gary Vaynerchuk.
Right.
So Gary was always the dude was like, hey, man, you should be on Twitter. I'm like, what the hell is that? He's like, just go sign up and get your name, get your business name.
So on his coaxing, you
put forward
on that. Oh, absolutely,
yeah. So I met Gary when we were... Gary was Wine Library, before Wine Library TV. He had come into Per Se to have dinner with a distributor. So he was there. My wife was actually waiting on the table, my girlfriend at the time. And I remember Gary gets up to go to the bathroom, and I'm looking at all the guys around the table. I'm like, who the hell is this guy? Like, who is this guy? And they go on to explain who are. And then me and Gary become fast friends. We shared a lot, talked a lot about, like, where he wanted to be in life and exactly where he is now. We talked and mused a lot about those things before. And as he was building different businesses and all these different things, you know, I was kind of there, you know, afar, being there and, like, listening to him. And he was always like, hey, and technology was a big thing for me, and to see how he incorporated technology into his business and how he did those things was really fascinating. And we became friends, and every time that there was something new, he was like, dude, you need to get on that, you need to check this out, you need to do that. And it was only because of him being I was an early adapter and got to use those things, and I used them in different ways. So I think it has helped me.
So he pulled you into
it. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
You got engaged.
Absolutely.
You stayed with it. He kept nudging you.
Yeah, he was like, dude, you got to be on this. Hey, now have you checked out Instagram?
But the initial question, that has become an important part
Correct.
Of what you
no,
do. Is it necessary?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it is, right? I think it's another way to be able to tell your story. And I think what happens is sometimes is that you also get to show the human side of that. Like, if you look at it, like, you know, what it meant to be a celebrity many years ago was shrouded in mystery, right? So the more recluse you could be,
less
the better.
Of that now.
And they didn't see you. But a big thing of what you see, what happens now, look at someone like Will Smith, who was an old Hollywood star, and now he's become a big Hollywood star because he's really adapted. And what we all wanted was an inside peek into his life and what it looked like. And now he's become one of the biggest stars in that. And I feel like in the same way on the winery side is that it's just not showing pictures of your grapes or talking about the wine, but also showing the human side of what it is and
the story.
The everyday of that, right? Because to the layman who's driving through, those vines all look the same. What really sets us all apart is our stories and being able to tell them and who we are and, like, what we find funny, what we don't find funny, what we eat, what we drink. It all seems narcissistic in some way, but there's people who want that.
When we talked about a newer generation of wine drinkers, yes. I think the story is more important.
Well, absolutely.
You know, I agree with that. Listen, I can't let you leave here, and we definitely have a little time to talk about where, you know, when you left,
correct,
what you're doing.
Correct. So I left in 2007, and I really wanted to learn more about wine, continue to learn more about wine. At this point, you know, I had one of the best jobs in the world for what I did as being a sommelier. I had five sommeliers that worked for me. But the downside of that is I didn't get to touch wine in the way that I wanted to, right? You know, it was about meetings, and meetings with the people that worked for me and all kinds of other stuff. And I wanted to be back to hands-on and learning about wine. And I felt like the only way to do that was to make my own. So if I could make my own, that could scratch several other itches I had for me. One, I wanted to be an entrepreneur. And then secondly, I wanted to have more creativity in my life. And in a roundabout way, I had no money, had nothing. I had all the relationships that I had. You know, I'm a firm believer in putting it out of the universe. I wrote an email to everybody I had ever worked with saying, it was a great meeting them and having this relationship with them, and that I was moving on to go make wine, and hopefully our paths will cross at some point. And from that, and from using that platform to say what I wanted to do next, there was an outpour of people saying that they wanted to help me get there. And long story short, you know, I started this company. We were making wine in California. We made wine in Napa, in Lompoc. And then finally settled on a place that really spoke to me was the Willamette Valley in Oregon. And so we've been there since 2007. And we've just been really making what I like to call food-friendly style wines. We really wanted to focus on everyday luxury wines, wines that were under $20 on the retail shelf, that actually could be featured in restaurants by the Glass program, and that really were transparent and honest and truly spoke of a place and over-delivered.
Do you think we should tell people what the name of the wine is?
Absolutely.
At this point?
The name of the wine is called, the name of my company is called Maison Noir Wines. We make a bevy of different wines, what we're probably most known for.
And you talked about what the mission is.
Correct.
I mean, which is making well-sourced wines at a good price.
Correct. I mean, that's always been it, right? Like when
people
you looked
don't
at
pull it,
it
off, though.
No one was talking about when they talked about wine by the glass, they always talked about price. They never talked about quality. And when I thought about wines by the glass, those wines need to be wines that were higher in acid, right? So they could last longer when they're open. So not that 2 to 3, but that 3 to 4 day range, right?
Right.
And then acids to amplify. The reason why you put salt on food, lemon on seafood, is really to crank up the flavors of a dish. So that's more of a condiment, right? And we wanted to make those wines, and I felt like that were honest, and that's kind of where we went. So we make other people's Pinot, OPP for short, which is, you know, it's basically, you know, it's the benchmark wine that we make. It, you know, it's everyday, you know, it's my interpretation of everyday drinking Willamette Valley Pinot Noir.
And everything is sourced from Oregon?
Everything's from Oregon. So we have long-term contracts that we've used.
Any aspirations of property and growing grapes?
Well, I mean, the fact of it is that this is the interesting part. When you can control the farming, then you don't really need to buy the land or own the land. So if you get your position, get
so
yourself
all your
in a position
partnerships
that,
with farmers.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you have some input and you get to control that. You know, and this is the different part, right? I've been around long enough that I understand that things are shifting. You know, now it's more about experiences. So having a property could be important. So we'll see that, you know. But right now I built it in the old world terms. And so we built it that way, and, you know, around the corner will be, you know, there will be, you know, there is property, but there will be a space for people to come and gather. And we've realized that. We've opened a family business in New York, which will open in May. It's called Ann Sons. It's our American charcuterie bar. So all-American charcuterie. It's in Prospect Lefferts Garden in Brooklyn.
Okay.
It's all-American charcuterie, all-American cheese, all-American wine with a focus on wines from the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Very cool.
20-seat wine bar. And it's really, you know, embracing this thing of like, and really to understand where we're going in the future, we need to really look back and embrace our past and being able to look at how those wines were made and understanding the people who came before us is how we're going to take American wine to the next forefront.
Great project.
Yep.
You mentioned OPP.
Yes.
Before we sign off, you have a lot more, you bottle a lot
more
stuff.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Talk to me about, you know, a couple of the,
yeah,
the,
so,
the bigger, you know,
other
brand.
People's Pinot. We do Pinot Noirs, which we started in 2009, and you know that's kind of what we're known for. This, you know, most case production that we do of that particular wine. We have OPP Pinot Gris, which is my interpretation of Pinot Gris, which is more on the Alsatian side. Love Drunk is our rosé. We started that in 2009, and that's continued to grow, and you've seen it kind of ride this wave of rosé and how that's kind of ridden into the sunset. Knock on Wood is our stainless steel Chardonnay. You know, for me, I've always taken to naming the wine something that that I think that resonates with people. You know, my thought was always is if I just put Andre Mack on the label, people are like, who the hell is this guy? Like, you know what I mean? Like, when I say Knock on Wood, we sub Love Drunk, those mean something to people.
Right.
They run through their
mystique deck. To it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And then we do single vineyard wines, Oregonia, Touche. So we kind of run the gamut. You know, we have the single vineyard wines that I still get to be experimental and be out there and be more hands-on. And then we have our everyday luxury wines, which it seems that it gives us a chance to connect with people on a broad scope from not just here in the United States, but to the 22 other countries that we sell wine in.
All right. So The name of the wine is Maison Noir. If people want to find out more information...
Sure, you can go to MaisonNoirWines.com, and there's a bevy of information there. If you live in a state or if you're one of the 33 states that we ship to, you can definitely order from there.
So you could buy directly from the site?
Absolutely, you can buy directly from us.
Distributed in stores?
We're distributed in stores. We're in almost every single state, so maybe 47 okay. states. So you can definitely find us
Does
there.
Does the site point you to retailers if you want?
Yes, you can actually
look
find
like
retailers.
New York, where's my Brooklyn wine shop?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, Absolutely. I want to thank Andre Mack. Andre Mack is the proprietor of Maison Noir Wines. You heard his story, and it's a fun and exciting one, and he's making some pretty good wines. Thank you for stopping by.
You're quite welcome.
And taking some time. Thank you. You're listening to The Grape Nation, and thank you to Le Creuset and the Julia Child Foundation for making Heritage Radio Network on tour Charleston Wine and Food possible. I'm Sam Ben Ruby for Heritage Radio Network and The Grape Nation. Remember, Heritage Radio Network is a member-supported nonprofit based in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Listen to over 10,000 episodes of food radio podcasts and become a member at heritageradionetwork.org. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.